All right, so I want to welcome our first guest speaker today. Now, Michael is a practicing employment lawyer, speaker, and author of two books. His first book was published in 2008, and it was titled Employed But Not Engaged: How to Break Up With Your Employees and Hold On to the Ring. So, Michael, it's a step-by-step guide for employers to get rid of those that need to be got rid of. And he's just written another book recently called Employed But Under Fire: Strategies for Dealing with a Difficult Boss. So Michael is a business person as well, so he understands the stresses and challenges of business, and he's a pretty funny guy as well. So without further ado, I'd just like to welcome Mr. Michael Smythe.
So their eyes met across a crowded room. It was love at first sight. A quick dance, a few beers, some champagne, it was all on. And then it was the honeymoon period. The honeymoon period was actually fantastic, but as we all know, the honeymoon period can come to an end. And then, of course, all those endearing little habits we know about that person all start to become really annoying habits. You know, that endearing laugh almost sounds like a cackle, the clothes strewn on the floor, the failure to fix the dripping leak from the roof. All these kind of things come really annoying. And all of a sudden, you wake up one day and you think, I've got to get out of here. This relationship is no longer for me. Well, it's a bit like that with employment relationships, isn't it? We employ someone, and it all seems to go quite well in the beginning. We get on well. For the first 90 days, it's fine. It carries on. And all of a sudden, the performance starts to drop. Who's experienced that before in the room? Yeah, hands up. Very good. So the performance starts to drop, and you think, first of all, you think, oh, I'll just ignore that. You know, they come in 5 minutes late, and then it's 10 minutes late, then it's quarter of an hour late, and we think, no, no, no. And then you wake up one day and think, no, this guy has got to go. What do you do? Well, the reason for that is because you're not alone. Statistics actually show that 1 in 10 New Zealand employees is actively disengaged with their work. About 60% are what we call ambivalent, and only about 30% are actively engaged with their work. That's pretty frightening statistics. So I don't know how many staff you all employ, but just do the maths. Some of you will be employing probably disengaged employees. So what is a disengaged employee? Well, we've said 1 in 10 New Zealand employees. Basically, they do the bare minimum not to get fired. Does this ring a bell with anybody? Yeah. They can turn up late into work. Cyber slacking. So if you're not familiar with that term, basically that means sitting on the computer all day on Facebook, Instagram, all those kind of social media channels, not actually doing any work. Insubordination, so they don't take instructions very easily. And they often take excessive leave. You know those employees who take sick leave on a Friday and a Monday? Yeah. You know those ones to get that nice long weekend? Okay, those are the kind of characteristics of a disengaged employee. An ambivalent employee, on the hand, they do what's necessary, but not much more. They come into work every day, they go home at 5 o'clock and they collect the paycheck. But these kind of people are quite interesting because you can actually motivate them to perform. So all the things you've been learning today, or will be learning today in this workshop about engaging employees and getting them to perform well, these are the type of people you can actually get them to up to speed and get them to perform, which is really good. But, here's a big but, they can be dragged down by the disengaged employees. If you've got one disengaged employee in your workplace, they can drag these ambivalent employees down. Now, if we look at the engaged employees, who are they? Well, they're the people who go the extra mile for your business. They'll probably be the ones that stay late at the end of the day. And statistics seem to show that they're actually worth 2 ambivalent employees. So we heard earlier about trying to retain key employees, maybe giving them shares in your company. Those are the kind of people you want to give that to, because they're actually worth a fortune to your business if you can get them motivated right. They stay late, they get in early, they make suggestions for improvement to your business. So that's what we mean by actively engaged. They're engaged with your business. They want your business to succeed. These are the guys you want, okay? And they're willing to take the lead in projects. So what this adds up to, it's a little bit of research has been done around disengaged employees and engaged employees, and this is what they say. An engaged workforce has a 95% higher return on assets than a disengaged workforce. An engaged workplace has 29% higher retention rates than a disengaged workforce. And an engaged workplace generates 60% more sales than a disengaged workplace. And we all want more sales, right? That's why you're here today. So we've got to make sure we get this staffing thing right. So if we've got a disengaged employee in our business, what do we need to do? We need to free up their future. You do not want them in your business. Now, if you've all seen The Apprentice, who's seen The Apprentice on TV? Donald Trump? Of course, what he would do, he would just come in and say, you're fired, and he'd just walk you out the door, and that'll be it. No discussion, nothing. That'd be great if we could do that here, wouldn't it? Because we can't do that here, and there's reason for that, because we have things like the Employment Relations Act, which says that you can be sued for a personal grievance. And of course, that means money. Not only money and potential damages if you get it wrong, but also money in having to engage possibly someone like me to appear for you or represent you in the Employment Relations Authority or something like that. And for a small business, if you're a small business, that can have a huge strain on your cash flow, because instead of investing money into your business to grow it, you're having to invest money in order to defend someone attacking your business. So the last thing you want to do is get involved in a personal grievance claim. So we need to avoid that. So that's what we're here to talk about today. And I thought before I start, I'd tell you a little bit more about myself. You had a little bit of an introduction there. So I'm an employment lawyer. So I give advice to clients on all aspects of employment law. I represent them before mediations before the Ministry of Innovation, Business and Employment. And I appear before the Employment Relations Authority, arguing cases, cross-examining witnesses, and all those kind of things that lawyers do. I'm also an author. Okay, so I've written two books, as Tony mentioned. The first one I wrote was Employment Not Engaged, which is basically a step-by-step guide how to get rid of disengaged employees without getting sued. It's written in layman's language, it's easy to read, and all that kind of stuff. And finally, I'm a speaker, which is why I'm here speaking to you today. So what we're going to cover today is basically two things. What you need to get rid of a disengaged employee. The first one is you need a reason. And the second thing is you need to have a good process. So we're going to go through both of those things today. Okay. So the first thing we're going to have a look at is what reason can you use to get rid of a disengaged employee. And when I was doing a bit of research for this presentation today, I thought, well, you know, because I'm all about how it's similar to the romantic relationship. And I stumbled across this website called SoYouveBeenDumped.com. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. What's that all about? And basically, it's people who have been dumped from a romantic relationship. They get to submit all the reasons and the lines that people have used against them to get rid of them out of this relationship. And I thought, oh, well, let's have a look. So let's have a look at some of the reasons people gave. I don't want you to feel as if I'm breaking up with you, but I just can't bear to be in a relationship with you anymore. Okay, I thought, well, that was kind of interesting, kind of saying the opposite of what you really mean. The next one, I know we've been together for years, but you're a Virgo, I'm a Scorpio, and we both know that Aries is so much better for me. Can you imagine having someone saying that to you? Okay. And then you got the inappropriate but honest excuse, maybe I just need to date someone who'll allow me to look at porn. Okay, so probably shouldn't use any of these lines if you're trying to dump someone from a romantic relationship. And also if you're trying to get rid of an employee. These reasons are just not going to cut it. So if you're trying to get rid of an employee, what kind of reasons can you give? Okay, so the first thing is the reason you give to an employee for getting rid of them must be genuine. Can't make it up, and I'll come back to what that means a little bit later. So what are the reasons that are recognized by law? Number one, misconduct. Now, we think we know what misconduct means. It's basically when people do things wrong. So within your business, you will have a set of rules, okay? You will find those rules probably in your employment agreement, and maybe you've also got a code of conduct. I heard someone mention that earlier when they were talking. Maybe you'll have an employee manual. So these are the kind of rules that say, you've got to be in work at 8:30, take your lunch break at such and such a time, you can't steal our intellectual property, all those kind of things. So if someone breaches a rule of your business, then that would be misconduct. That's to be differentiated from poor performance, which is the next reason. So sometimes people get poor performance and misconduct mixed up. Poor performance is all about if your employee does not reach the standards that you're expecting them to carry out their role. So the standards, which for that role, will be contained where? Does anybody know? Shout out if you do. Job description, correct. So if you're looking at poor performance, you're probably going to be looking more at the job description than the employment agreement itself or your employee manual. So things like coming in late to work sounds a little bit like performance, but in actual fact, that's misconduct because that's a rule that you've got to be in at a certain time. However, if someone is not making sales or their standard of their workmanship is not very good, that's a performance issue. And the process around both is just slightly different, okay? The other reason that you could get rid of somebody is redundancy. That basically means that their role is no longer required in the business. The role, not the person, has become surplus to requirements. The next reason is incapacity. This relates to medical incapacity. So if someone were to, for example, break their leg and then couldn't work for 3 to 4 months, that could be a genuine reason to terminate the employment agreement. Again, there's a slightly different process that you need to follow for incapacity compared to redundancy. And the final reason for terminating the employment agreement is resignation. Now you think, hold on, isn't resignation something that the employee does? Well, that's correct. But for example, if an employee didn't turn up for work for 3 to 4 days without any reason, that would be called abandonment of employment, and that is effectively a resignation. Now, those are the only reasons you can actually terminate the employment of an employee. So you can't terminate their employment because they've got red hair, because you don't like them, or for any other reason like that. Some reasons, in fact, are actually prohibited by the Human Rights Act, discrimination. You can't terminate them because they believe in a certain religion, or if they're a certain nationality, etc. So those are the only reasons you can give. So if you're going to go down this dismissal path, you've got to try and fit the conduct of your employee into one of these categories. Now, very often, I get employers come to me and say, oh, look, we got this employee, and he's really no good. Like, he comes in late to work. Standard of his workmanship is really poor. Can we just make him redundant? And I think, oh, hold on a minute. What you're telling me is that he's you know, breaching some rule in your business or his performance is not very good, but you're saying that you want to make him redundant because he's surplus to requirements. So immediately in my head, the bells start ringing because it doesn't sound to me that this is a genuine redundancy. So if you remember back at the beginning, I said, if you're going to have a reason, it's got to be genuine. So you can't just make up a reason if that's not the real reason. So you should always avoid using redundancy as your reason if that's not really why you're trying to get rid of the person, okay? So if it's really misconduct, go down the misconduct path. If it's really poor performance, go down the poor performance path, unless you genuinely have no reason for that role in your business. Because I tell you what, if you try and dress up a poor performance or a misconduct issue as a redundancy, there's lots of clever people around like me who will find out. Because we're trained to try and find or identify these kind of sham redundancies. And the law on redundancy has got a little bit better for the employee, because what the Employment Relations Authority is doing now is it's actually analysing whether a redundancy is genuine. Okay? It's actually looking, what I would call looking under the hood, and saying, well, look, is this really genuine? Show us your figures. Show us your profit and loss account. Show us your balance sheet. Is this really a genuine redundancy? I think I've got another slide on that. So I'm going to identify for you some of the problems with redundancy, merely to illustrate to you that you can't use this as a reason to get rid of someone unless it is actually a genuine redundancy. So the first one is it must be a genuine reason. Okay, so don't try and dress it up as something else. You must provide sufficient information about the reason to allow the employee to comment. So as part of the redundancy process, you've got to go through consultation with your employee. Now, your employee can turn around and say, I want more information about that. So if you're saying, the reason we want to get rid of you is because sales have dropped, your employee can turn around and say, well, give me the figures. Demonstrate that to me. Show me your profit and loss account. Demonstrate to me how your sales have dropped from that year to that year. And if you can't show that, the employee is going to know that it's not a genuine redundancy, and the Employment Relations Authority is going to know it's not a genuine redundancy. And when you go to court, you will be expected to produce all this information to the court to demonstrate that it is a genuine redundancy. Don't expect the authority or the court to take your word for it. They will analyse your decision. The second problem with the redundancy, if you're saying that the role is surplus to requirements, you can't then employ someone else to fill the same role, because the role doesn't exist. Sounds obvious, doesn't it, really? But you can't. So again, you know, if you went down a misconduct route, you could, of course, because it's misconduct, just get someone in to replace them. And then there's the whole issue of redeployment. So what a lot of people do is they say, okay, what we'll do is we'll restructure our business. So the role that person's in over there, we'll change the role significantly and create a new role over here, and we'll make that person redundant, and then we'll go through a recruitment process for that role, and we just won't choose that guy. Has anyone ever done that or heard of people doing that? Anybody? Yeah, there's a few people. Okay, there's a problem with that, because the law on redeployment says if the person you're making redundant has the skills and expertise to do the new role, you must redeploy them into that role. So you can go through this whole restructure process and still be no further forward. You've still got the guy in your business, okay? So if you're gonna do that, you've gotta make that position so different, both in terms of the role itself, but also in terms of the skills and experience required for that role, in order that you can then go, well, we're not gonna redeploy you, instead, we're gonna go to the open market. You're welcome to apply, but you may not get the job. Okay, so not a lot of people know that, and it's a common trap for employers going down a redundancy process. So remember about redeployment. And the last thing, which is more of a practical thing, is that if you go through a redundancy process in your business, think about the effect it's going to have on your other staff. All of a sudden, people start talking about redundancies, and people think, oh God, is my job safe? You know, has this company got financial trouble? Am I going to lose my job? And you might find that some of the key staff, the people you want to keep, all of a sudden start getting a little bit nervous and they start looking for jobs elsewhere. So don't rush down this redundancy path, because it can be a little bit fraught, both in terms of the legal process, and it can also affect the morale in your business, and that's the last thing you want to do. So my advice to you is, if you've got an employee who's just simply not turning up to work on time, or their performance is not very good, hit it straight on the head. Go down a performance route or go down a misconduct route. Don't try and dress it up as a redundancy, unless, of course, it is a genuine redundancy, in which case, feel free. Okay? The next section we're going to have a look at is the process we're going to go through. But before I do that, what I wanted to do is that we've talked a lot about redundancy, and probably redundancy is one of the most difficult processes to go through when you're trying to get rid of an employee, particularly now in light of recent law and recent case law. And what I've actually got a specimen redundancy checklist, which could be quite useful for you. And I heard you're all into your checklist. I think they're all in your manual and all that kind of stuff. So I've got a checklist. And what I'm also offering is a free telephone consultation of up to 30 minutes, which you can take up before the end of February next year. So that's basically my gift to you, if you want to take that up. All you need to do is just put your name and email address on there if you want it. You don't have to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send this around the room. I'll start over here, and if you can just pass that around. If you don't want it, that's fine. But if you do want that redundancy checklist and you do want to have a chat to me at some stage over the next couple of months about an employment issue, just fill out your name there and we'll do that, okay? You just got to ring me up. And I've got business cards here if you need to get hold of my number. Okay, so that's that. So the next section is all about process. How do you actually go through that process? You've got your genuine reason. How do you get through the process of getting to a dismissal? Now, in the old days, if you remember, for all my time anyway, during the war, we didn't have things like telephones and internet and all that kind of stuff. So if you wanted to break up with somebody, and your partner was over fighting on the Eastern Front, what you do is you'd write a letter.
Dear John.
Dear John. The old Dear John letter. And of course, they would receive it about 2 weeks later, probably. Be very upset. You wouldn't have to actually see them face to face. It would all be a little bit remote. And of course, you wouldn't have to deal with the issue until they came back from war, which was kind of good, I suppose. And then, of course, times moved on, and we got telephones and better communication. And of course, answer machines. So that's great, isn't it? You just ring them up, leave a message on the answer phone. Oh, sorry. I don't want to be with you anymore. It's, again, avoiding confrontation. That's great, isn't it? So that's another way you could kind of avoid that whole confrontation thing. Of course, nowadays, all you do is you just change your relationship status on Facebook and that's done the job for you. Again, it's all about avoiding confrontation. And of course, as human beings, we don't like confrontation. There's not many people, I would imagine, in this room who really enjoys confrontation. You think, as a lawyer, I would, because that's kind of my job. But even I don't like confrontation, particularly when it's personal, you know, and it's your business or it's, you know, your relationship or something like that. So we naturally try and avoid confrontation as much as we possibly can, which is why I think a lot of employers fall into this trap of not going through a proper process, because that actually requires sitting down with your employee face to face and talking about things like misconduct or you just shit at your job. You know, we don't like having those kind of conversations with people, do we? I mean, so it's kind of hard. So what I thought I'd do is I'd take a sort of misconduct example, maybe, and work through that process with you and just demonstrate how the process should operate. But before doing that, I wanted to say a quick word about trial periods. And the reason I've slotted trial periods in here is because we think when we've got someone on a 90-day trial period, we don't really need to think about process that much. And that's correct, because if you got a trial period and you dismiss someone within those first 90 days, you are essentially immune from a personal grievance for an unjustified dismissal claim. So you think, okay, well, that's good. Won't get sued for an unjustified dismissal. I'm completely in the clear. All I need to do is just get rid of this guy and everything's great. The problem is that since the trial period legislation was introduced, there's a lot of fish hooks to it. And if you don't cover off all the fish hooks, then you're going to get in trouble. So we're going to run through what those fish hooks are now. The first point is that your trial period must be in writing. Okay, so the trial period must form part of your offer of employment. So in your offer letters that you give to your employees, if you don't actually attach the employment agreement to it, I know a lot of people who don't, they just send the letter off and get the letter signed and then get the letter back and they deal with the agreement later. That letter must be clear that it says that the employment is subject to a 90-day trial period. So if your offer letters don't say that, go back and amend them now. After this session this morning. Okay, so that's the first thing. Second thing, the agreement itself, the employment agreement, must contain a 90-day trial period clause. Not a probationary period clause. A probationary period is something very, very different. So it must be a trial period clause, and it must be compliant with the Act. So it should reference the section of the Act which deals with trial periods. And it should say in there that the employee is not entitled to raise a personal grievance or unjustified dismissal. So that's one of the key components of a trial period clause. Before trial periods came in, we used to have something called probationary periods. And of course, they didn't comply with the Act because the Act wasn't in place then. And what a lot of employers did when trial periods came in, they just swapped the name probationary for trial. Well, that doesn't work. You've actually got to have a proper trial period clause that complies with the Act. So that's the first fishhook, got to have it in writing. A lot of employers I've come across simply think because it's in legislation, you can rely on it. No, no, no. Got to be in the employment agreement. We've talked about it must comply with the Act. And this is a key one. The employment agreement must be signed before the employee starts work. So as part of your employment practices, you should send that employment agreement out before the commencement date, get that agreement signed before the commencement date, and then let the employee start work. It is no good for the employee to come in on the first day, do a couple of hours of work, and then present him with an employment agreement to sign. Too late. That trial period will not be legally enforceable. Okay? Because the employee is deemed to be an existing employee of the business when the agreement is signed. So under the Act, a trial period can only apply to someone who is not an existing employee of the business. If they start work at 9 o'clock and sign the agreement at 10 o'clock, at 10 o'clock they're an existing employee of the business. So it will not be valid. Sorry?
If it's the other way around, so if they sign at 9 o'clock and start at 10 o'clock, that's sufficient.
That's fine.
So they're not going to turn around and say, oh, I didn't have time to read it, I just signed because I had to start at 10 o'clock. And
well,
so is there a sufficient amount of time?
That's fine, that's fine, but you should always give an employee an opportunity to get legal advice on an employment agreement.
Yeah. That's what I was going
to
say.
Yeah. Has to be before that commencement date. I would strongly disencourage you from presenting an employment agreement to an employee on the first day of work. Okay?
Tony referred to don't try to do an interview, but having them working for you for a couple of hours or an afternoon or a day to see what they're like. Is that covered already? Like, have you given that?
Very dangerous. Very dangerous, because they could be considered to be an existing employee. So before the trial period legislation came in, a lot of employers used to do that. They used to have these mini trial periods, and they didn't used to pay people for those periods. And it used to be essentially an extension of the job interview. Now, there's not a lot of, since the trial period legislation came in, there's not a lot of case law on how those two things relate together. But I would suggest it's very, very dangerous, because you run the risk that when the agreement gets eventually signed, they could argue that they were an existing employee when they signed the agreement. Now, your argument is, of course, well, they may have done a little bit of work, but we didn't pay them, so therefore they were not an employee at that time. It was just an extension of the job interview. So if you are going to do that, you have to be very, very clear to them that this is not work as part of your employment. This is just part of the job interview. So there's nothing wrong as part of your job interview saying, well, you know, go and fix a pipe or whatever you do, is just to test their skills. But I would strongly disencourage you from doing it over any lengthy period of time. So maybe an afternoon might be okay. But you know, if you start moving into the second day and the third day, it starts to look like employment.
Would a good way of getting around that be to say, get them in the van with you or your lead guy for just an afternoon where they're in an observation capacity?
Yep.
And they ask them to do a single task during that period?
Yep, that should be fine. As long as it's part of the interview process. To say they're not an employee, that's another way to do it. Yep. But yeah, that piece of paper needs to be quite drafted quite clearly. So obviously you're not getting paid for what you're doing. We might reimburse you for some travel expenses, but that's about the top end of what you can do. And they acknowledge that they're not an employee, it's just part of the interview selection process. So you can do it, I'm not saying you can't, but you just need to be very, very careful. No, he wouldn't be an employee under... If he's an independent contractor, he wouldn't be considered to be an employee when you changed him over.
So you could put him in.
However, there's a big but here, because whether someone is an employee or not doesn't depend solely on what's put in the contract. Okay? It comes down to what is the real nature of the relationship. So that employee or independent contractor could argue that when they were an independent contractor, under law, they were actually an employee. So again, you've got difficulties there. But what I'd say to you is this, if you've had someone as an independent contractor for however long, why would you need a 90-day trial period? You already know what they're like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you shouldn't really need a 90-day trial period for somebody you already know. And that's the purpose around the legislation. It's really designed for those kind of people who come in raw to your business, so you don't know who they are, and you just want to test them out. Again, problems. So you get a clever little employment lawyer like me who would pick up on that. So not even employment lawyers know about this. So the difficulty is that if your offer letter goes out without the 90-day reference to 90 days, and you get them to sign the offer letter, the legal argument goes like this. But we've already concluded the contract when I signed the offer letter. The offer letter didn't tell me that it was subject to a 90-day trial period. The 90-day trial period only came later when they presented me with the agreement. Well, if it's here's your contract, presumably the contract contains a 90-day trial period, so that's fine. That's not a problem because the contract's attached to the offer letter. But what the example I gave you was if the offer letter goes out without the contract and there's no reference at all to the 90-day trial period, don't do that because that could get you into hot water. Not all the time, because there will be some people who don't pick up on it, but strictly speaking, that they would argue that the contract's been concluded before the offer of the 90-day trial period came into play. Okay? So a lot of questions about 90-day trial periods, aren't there? Wow!
Isn't there some sort of limitation on the amount of staff leveling you have before you're not allowed to have a trial period?
No, used to be businesses under 20 employees when it first came in. And then it's changed. So any employer can now utilise the 90-day trial period. So when it first came out, it was designed for small businesses. And I think 20 employees was the maximum, but now it's anybody can use it.
Can I just ask, do you recommend once that they get another contract after that trial period's up?
No, you don't need to.
Just have an end date on it.
Just have an end date.
Right.
In fact, that might segue into the next point. Oh no, not quite. Can't be more than 90 days. So I had a client the other day who came to me and said, I've had two clients. One client came to me and said, hadn't got a 90-day trial period. The employee was sick for a month, so we gave them leave without pay. And they were at day 80 of the trial period. Can we extend the trial period? No. Even if you've lost a month because the employee's off sick, can't extend the trial period. But I had a client that did extend the trial period and then wanted to get rid of someone, didn't consult me, got rid of them, personal grievance. So you cannot go beyond 90 days. You can go less than 90 days, but not beyond.
Is there a point at which a contractor defaults to being like an employee? If you've got a guy that you pay $40 an hour to show up for you, only really works for you.
He is just a
contractor no matter what. If he's still if his entire employment or his entire work is with you.
Yes.
Is he an employee?
Yes. Potentially. So go back to that point I made earlier. So the definition of an employee comes back to what's the real nature of the relationship. So not necessarily what's stated in the contract, but the Employment Relations Authority will look at all the factors. And the fact that they just work for you is strongly indicative of an employment relationship. If you're paying them an hourly rate, that could be indicative as well. But are they invoicing? Well, that's probably independent contractor. Are they paying GST? Maybe you're doing. There's all these factors. And what they do is they put them all into a set of scales and they weigh them up and they say, well, that's more like an employee or that's more like an independent contractor. So the best thing to do is if you've got an independent contractor, have an agreement. So at least you've got that in writing. Although the agreement is not cast iron, at least you've got something in writing. So for an employee, you must have an employment agreement. If you don't, you'll get fined up to $2,000, $3,000 just for not having an employment agreement. So if there's anybody in the room who doesn't have employment agreements, get them now, because you're already in breach of the law. With independent contractors, you don't have to have employment agreements, but my strong recommendation is that you do, because at least that gives you something to say, well, look, that's what we agreed at the time. Because it does actually come back to the intention of the parties when the employment relationship or the relationship was entered into. Well, first of all, I'm very nervous of people who rely on gentlemen's agreements, number one. So that red flags go up straight away. So as soon as he wouldn't sign the agreement, I'd have said, well, sorry, buddy. I'm not prepared to engage with you on those terms. But as I say, so it comes back to the real nature of the relationship. He obviously knows a bit about the law. And he thought, well, okay, I come to this guy's work every day. I get paid an hourly rate. Therefore, I think I'm an employee. So that's the typical kind of case that would end up in the Employment Relations Authority where you get an argument over is he an employee or is he not. And one of the problems with this is that, when you enter into the relationship, usually there's no problems because you want him and he wants to work for you. Where it gets problems, say with an independent contractor, is you say, well, I don't really need this guy anymore. 2 weeks notice, see you later. And then they think, hold on a minute, that's not fair. Then they go and get some advice, and the lawyer says to them, well, actually, are you really an independent contractor? It looks to me as if you're an employee. And that's when the argument comes. It's when you start to get rid of them. Because all of a sudden they realize as an independent contractor, they've got no rights. So they then try and argue that they're an employee, so they can get the rights of the Employment Relations Act.
Yep. As opposed to paying the
work
themselves, so that's
yeah. So they're separate. So they would be employed by trade staff, as I understand it. So you're just you pay trade staff for their services. Yeah. So they will probably have.
Because I plan to engage them next year.
Yeah, so they're an employment agency which employs staff direct, and you pay the agency and then they supply the staff. So there's no direct employment relationship between you and the staff there. So you're okay. Yeah.
Just one
thing
I'll move on. With this 90-day trial, I know at the end of it I can't go, oh, you were shit, you're gone. You know, like,
yeah.
You still have to follow the processes of reviews and stuff. I mean, I can't just go 90 days and go, sorry, Michael, you're done.
Okay.
You've actually got to run the process, I assume, and have a review with the guy, and you're not good enough or whatever.
Okay. So this is the point here. So we'll get back to the slides because I'm conscious also that you've got to have lunch at some stage. Whilst I'm terribly interesting, you probably want to get some food inside your stomach. So the next bullet point there is must comply with the duty of good faith. So as employers and employees equally, you have a duty of good faith towards each other. So that means you've got to be communicative, responsive, not do anything to undermine the employment relationship, all those kind of things. So what does that actually mean in practice? Well, what it probably means is that when you dismiss this guy, you first of all got to tell him why. Okay, so if it's a performance issue, tell them it's a performance issue. What I recommend to my clients is that you at least, when you sit them down and say, look, you know, your work's not up to scratch, I say to them, well, look, actually get their comments on that first before you actually make the decision to get rid of them. I think that's just good faith. You know, have a chat to them, say, well, look, you know, we've noticed your performance is not that good. Why do you think that is? Give them the opportunity to at least persuade you not to dismiss them. So that's all about the duty of good faith. You don't have to have warnings. Not under this, because you can't be sued for an unjustified dismissal. But you do need to be communicative with that employee. So it's not a process in the sense that we're going to talk about in a minute, but at least have some kind of communication. Don't text them. You're fired. Okay? That's not good faith. Okay? You know, sit them down, explain the problem, get their feedback. If you're not satisfied about their feedback, then get rid of them. Okay? So that's important. And you must give notice within the trial period. So, say for example, the employment agreement says you've got to give a week's notice. Providing you give the notice within the 90 days, you're okay. Even if the notice takes you beyond the 90 days, that's all right. So the notice must be given within the 90 days. One thing that's not up there is don't pay them in lieu. Okay, so you know what payment in lieu means? So say for example they've got a week's notice, don't say, oh look, we'll just pay you, go today. Okay, payment in lieu doesn't work with 90-day trial periods. You actually have to give them notice. So if it's a week's notice, you actually give them notice. What you can do though, is you can say, you've got a week's notice, but we don't require you to come into work for the week. So you'll be paid at the end of the week, your final pay. But don't, on the day you dismiss them, don't pay them their final pay then. Because that's a payment in lieu, okay? Sorry?
Would you have to give them 2 weeks notice?
Depends what the contract says. So here's the thing. So your employment agreement can have two notice periods. It can have a notice period for permanent employees and a notice period for your trial period. So there's no rule about how long the notice period is. It's a matter for agreement between the parties. So what I generally do is for my trial periods, it's always, and they're no longer than a week. I know some clients who have like 3 days. Yours is one, is it 90 days? Yeah, that's
change it out for 90
days. Yeah. And then once the 90 days is over, then it might move to 4 weeks or 2 weeks or whatever you want. But there's no requirement to have 2 weeks. So you can change that, okay? And the theory behind that, if you've got a 90-day provision, you really want to get rid of them quite quickly. You don't want them hanging around.
Just on that, when you call them in and they've given you comments, do you have to be
for a 90-day trial period?
Yeah, on the
trial. I would suggest you probably don't. I think you probably could do it there and then. Very much. So you can't be sued for an unjustified dismissal. The only thing you could be sued for is an unjustified disadvantage, which could be breach of the duty of good faith. So, providing you can say, well, look, we got his comments, we listened to him, but we weren't satisfied. You've complied with the duty of good faith. So I think you're fine. Slightly different, though, is if you're not a 90-day trial period employee and you want to go through a misconduct process, you don't do that. Get them over desk and slap them. You've actually got to go through a process. So what I'm going to do is just talk you through a quick misconduct process so you just get a good idea of how you've got to go through it. Okay? It's similar for poor performance, but slightly different. But we'll use misconduct in this case. So the first thing you've got to do if your employee has done something naughty, can someone give me an example of something, practical example you've come across of misconduct in your workplace maybe?
Moonlighting.
Okay. All right. Moonlighting whilst on ACC. Okay. So you discover this in your workplace and you think, oh, this is not good. We need to bring this to the attention of our employee. So the first thing you're going to do is you're probably going to write a letter to the employee to invite them to a disciplinary meeting. And this letter is going to set out exactly what the allegations are. So you need to be specific and detailed. Okay. So you need to say, so take the moonlighting example. On such and such a day, so-and-so saw you working for so-and-so whilst you should have been at home because you're on ACC. So give them enough detail about the allegations so they fully understand what case they have to answer. Okay, think of it, if you put yourself in their shoes, what would you want to know if you had to defend this allegation? So you've really got to set it out in some detail. So identify what the breach is. So what you may want to do is you may want to reference a clause in your employment agreement, reference a paragraph in your code of conduct or in your employee manual or something like that. So if you could actually pull out the relevant clause, that's so much better if you could whack that in your letter. Provide any relevant documents. So what could this be? Let's give a performance example. So if it's a sales issue, you might want to give examples of sales that have been made or not made or things like that. So any documents that are relevant. Yeah, absolutely. So you might want to provide a printout of whatever. Anything that's going to adequately inform them about the allegations in order that they can respond, basically, you've got to include. It's all part of your duty of good faith. Invite a support person to the meeting. Okay, that's quite important. And provide reasonable time before the disciplinary meeting. I'm waiting for the hand to go up. What's reasonable? So what is reasonable? What is reasonable? I don't know. I mean, 48 hours could be. I mean, I think it really depends upon what the nature of the allegation is. So if it's a, I'll just finish this before I lose it. If it's a complicated allegation of, say, fraud, where the consequences for him are going to be instant dismissal, you might want to give it a little bit longer, okay? Because they've got to consider the documents, probably get legal advice, arrange a support person, come along to the meeting. If the allegation is you turned up quarter of an hour late to work, well, you know, you can probably deal with that in 24 hours, can't you? So again, it's not, there's no defined time limit as to how long between the letter and the meeting, but it just needs to be reasonable, and that depends upon the nature of the allegation. So the more serious, probably the longer you'll probably give. But also you can suspend, if it is serious, you can suspend the employee from work during that period as well. Yes, let me talk about suspensions a little bit. So you can only suspend an employee from work where the allegation is serious and where there's actually a genuine reason for not having them at work. So if they had, for example, punched someone, the other employee's not going to feel very comfortable sort of working alongside this guy for the next 5 days while you carry out a disciplinary process. That would be a good reason. If they've stolen some property, intellectual property, you'd probably want to get them out of the workplace so they didn't do it again. So that must be a genuine reason for the suspension. So it must be serious and genuine reason. And you also must get their comments on it, or the proposed suspension, before you actually suspend them. So there's a little mini process you've got to go through first before you actually make that decision. Don't just walk in one day and say, right, off you go, we'll see you in 5 days. Okay, you've got to talk to them about it first and give them the opportunity to get advice. Who had the question? You did.
Yeah, I mean, for us, some of the issue was that they were on ACC, so they're basically
Yes, so what did you do? Email the letter to them or courier the letter to them?
Well, they finally come around and you need a medical
certificate. Yeah.
Letter about the planning process. But again, they wanted to not have any power, but they're like, oh, we want to work, we're on sick leave.
He was in Bali, actually.
I was in Bali. Well, so you're going to have difficulty having a disciplinary meeting then, aren't you? Look, you've got to make your best attempt to go through a disciplinary process. Were you paying this person at the time? Because they're on ACC, presumably not.
Well, yeah, they had the 1 week
yeah.
And then they were
not being paid.
So we just let it sit though, because it was something serious enough that it was like, it needs to be dealt with, rather
yeah.
than, you know, 3 months' time.
Yeah.
I will hang around at lunchtime,
conscious of...
For other people to know, like yeah. if someone's on ACC and you've got a process that you need to deal with...
You've got to do the best you can to go through that process. And there's certain things you can do, and that's where I guess that's where I come in and sort of say, well, look, you know, can we try this? Have we tried that? I've been around the traps a few years, and I've seen every form of employee behaviour imaginable, and I know the tricks people can play, and I know strategies for getting around them. So that's where I guess that little bit of advice can help. So then you have, your disciplinary meeting, and what you've got to do there is you've got to listen with an open mind. Now, that's very difficult, isn't it? Because you've probably already formed a kind of conclusion already as to what the conduct is and whether what the outcome's going to be. But the law says you've got to have an open mind and listen to their explanations. And it can happen. You can be surprised. An employee can have a good explanation. You can think, oh, actually, you know, maybe I'll jump to a conclusion there. So do that. Get their comments on the sanctions. So particularly with misconduct. So when you're going through a misconduct process, there's a number of sanctions available. Verbal warning, first written warning, final warning, dismissal. And your policy on misconduct may dictate that you go through that process of warnings. And it would be, you're obligated to do that anyway, unless the conduct is so serious that you feel that you can skip one of those processes. So if it's, particularly if it's a serious misconduct issue, or you believe it's a serious misconduct issue, it's very important to get their comments on what the appropriate sanctions should be. Because you're saying, we're going to dismiss you. They may say, well, look, hands up, I did do something wrong, but it doesn't justify dismissal. Maybe it's just the first written warning. So make sure you go through that process as well and get their comments on the sanction. Then we adjourn the meeting, which is what you said earlier. And the reason for doing that is just so you can demonstrate that you've thought about it, really. If you jump to a conclusion straight away, you're going to get an allegation of, well, it was all predetermined. So many times I've heard employees say, well, I was at the disciplinary meeting, I couldn't say anything because they just spoke over me, and then they made a decision straight away. It's all predetermined. They, you know, and it's very difficult to kind of argue against that. So at least if you adjourn the meeting, you give that impression that you've actually thought about it before you make the decision. But what you may find is during the course of the disciplinary meeting, they may raise issues which you need to then go and investigate further. So they may say, oh, but so-and-so over there, he saw me do this and this and this. So you think, okay, well, I need to go then and speak to that person, get a witness statement from them. Once I've got the witness statement, have another disciplinary meeting to put that witness statement back to the employee and get their comments again. So you might not necessarily get through it all in one meeting. You might have to do several meetings to get to the bottom of what's going on. And then, of course, you make your decision. And providing you do that with an open mind and you can justify it, the test at law is what a reasonable and fair employer could have done in the circumstances. And that implies that there is actually a possible range of things you can do, and you only have to get your decision within one of those things in order for it to be justified. The old test used to be would, what a reasonable and fair employer would do, which presupposed there was only one outcome, but the law kind of gives you a little bit of leeway nowadays. So, and then hopefully if you've gone through that process correctly, you won't get a personal grievance. If you do, that's where I come in. Okay.
Do you need an independent person to take minutes of the actual meeting and then after that time up and get two parties to sign it?
That's certainly recommended practice.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because you might need evidence of what was actually said at that meeting. So if you've got someone independent who's taken the minutes, then there can be little argument. Often you get employees who refuse to sign these things. Doesn't matter if they refuse to sign it. I'm getting the 10 minutes. I'm actually about 1 minute, so it's all good. So if they refuse to sign it, that's not a problem. You just put your version and say, well, look, if you want to provide an alternative version, we'll put both on file, and that's fine. But when it comes to the Employment Relations Authority, it's actually quite handy to have a typed written record of what was said at the meeting. It avoids any argument later. Yeah.
Just a good fun question then.
Yes, go on.
What's the average cost of a personal grievance?
Average cost of a personal grievance, okay. There are two types of damages which an employee can claim for. The first is damages for loss of earnings, which effectively is the amount of time the employee is out of work until they find another job. The Employment Relations Act says that it's either 3 months or the lesser of that period, but the authority has the discretion to go over 3 months, so it could be anything, really. However, the employee has a positive obligation to mitigate their loss, which means they can't just sit on their hands and do nothing. They've actually got to get out there and look for alternative employment. But potentially, so you could argue that potentially you're up for 3 months' salary. The second type of damages is damages for, and you're going to cringe at this, hurt, humiliation, injury to feelings, all those kind of things. They're kind of emotional things, okay? Now, what we used to say to people is that the average award in the Employment Relations Authority, or the median award, was somewhere around that $6,000 mark, tax-free, to the employee. However, some recent cases out of the Employment Court have indicated that that's too low, and we're starting to see the awards go a little bit higher. But generally in the Employment Relations Authority, they rarely go over $15,000. And the dangerous thing for you is if you've got an employee who starts producing medical evidence of, you know, I suffered depression afterwards and all that kind of stuff, and if you get one of those, you're looking at an award at the top end of the scale. And then, of course, there's your legal fees. If you choose to have a lawyer. Now, it won't surprise you to know that lawyers can charge anything from there to there, depending on whether you go to Simpson Grierson or Joe Bloggs in the High Street. So, you know, who you choose will depend on how much your legal fees are going to be. To get to a mediation, which is the first step in the process, you probably won't get much change out of $2,500. To go to an Employment Relations Authority hearing, it could be anything from $15,000 to $40,000 to defend one of those. So I recently did a sexual harassment claim, which was 3 days in the authority, came out somewhere around about $30,000, $35,000 in terms of legal fees. If you win, you can get a proportion of those legal fees back, but it's a very small amount. Depends upon the length of the hearing. So for a one-day hearing, you get about $3,500 back. So if you've spent $15,000, and you're only going to get $3,500 back. Even if you win, you're going to be $12,000 out of pocket. Which is why, when you go to mediation, there's a lot of sense just trying to settle it and get rid of it. But you may think, though, matter of principle, this guy doesn't deserve it. And perfect, you know, I've got no problem with that. As long as you're aware. If you ever seen that cartoon, you know, where everyone's fighting and there's a lawyer in the middle going, yeah, this is great. Because, you know, obviously I get paid, but you know, I have had clients, and I frequently get clients who do these things out of a matter of principle. Because if you've got someone who's really damaged your business, the last thing you want to do is pay them, you know, a few grand to go away. You think, you know, sometimes, I had a client who had an employee who stole a lot of their intellectual property, huge amount of intellectual property. They were a website development company, website plans. Then they started soliciting staff to leave the company. Huge stuff. And they came to me and said, look, we want to get an injunction against this guy. We want to get damages. We want to get a financial penalty. And I said, well, look, the costs are going to be X. You'll probably recover. And the guy was a bankrupt as well. That was the other thing. So you probably would never get any money out of him. And they said, don't care. Don't care. We just want to make an example of this guy. And they did. Went to a 3-day hearing. And the authority said, this guy's got to pay you $50,000 in penalties for what he did. And the reason they did that was because they wanted to demonstrate to all their other staff and also people in their industry that you can't get away with stealing people's intellectual property. It was purely a matter of principle for them. Now, if you're a small business, you probably can't afford to do things as a matter of principle. But if you're a bit more of an established business, maybe you can. And that's a genuine reason for wanting to go to the authority. But those are the kind of things you've got to weigh up at mediation. And it's all about just trying to get the best outcome for you, really. One thing I will say to you, though, is that getting involved in litigation can be not only costly, but it also can take up a lot of your time, and it can distract you from your business. So you've been talking about all your 90-day plans this morning. I can tell you what, if you've got litigation on, you won't be thinking about 90-day plans. You know, your 90-day plan will be get rid of this litigation, and you won't be thinking about building your business.
In the last 15 years, we've had two misconduct hearings. The first one we held ourselves and missed a minor point, and Michael turned up as a lawyer and missed us, and we lost 10 grand.
Oh, did I?
No, not you.
Oh, I say, I don't remember.
Someone as clever as you, Michael. So, the last time we had this,
yes,
we employed Michael, or
yeah, someone like that,
to run our mediation for us, and it cost us $1,200. So, what we knew at the conclusion of that meeting, that although their recommendation was it was a dismissible offence, we actually opted not to dismiss the employee because he was a valued employee.
Yeah.
He just made a judgment error.
Yeah.
So, but what it did do was it stopped us from having all this problem of litigation and having to go down this road and having to go to mediation. We paid the $1,200 up front for a guy for 3 to 4 hours, two different sittings.
Yeah.
Done. So no matter what happened out of that, chances are we were 100% correct in whatever came from.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens when the employee knows what's going on and they've done their homework, they turn up and go with stress, got letters from the doctor, you know it's all bullshit.
Oh, they can come and all that, when you read,
take that personal grievance and just go, here's your 8 grand, bang, out the door now.
Yeah, that's certainly a way you can do it. So I'm an advocate of getting advice up front, you know, so try not to wait till the personal grievance arrives before you get advice. You know, if you're going to go through a process like misconduct redundancy, get your advice before you start the process, because it can pay dividends later on, because you can actually avoid the personal grievance in the first place. So that's my recommendation to you. That's what this book's all about. I've got a few copies here if people want them. I'm actually running out of print, actually, believe it or not. So I've got a few copies of that. So get the advice up front, but if you do get into personal grievance, it is worth getting some advice and probably trying to settle it at mediation. So, so you've been dumped.com. Take a look. It's quite interesting, quite funny. one of the things was, I'm leaving. Do you want me to go tonight or tomorrow? Thank you.